Hey everyone, I know you've heard me talk about this before, but you can now hear How Did I Get Here along with 5,000 other shows while on the go with Stitcher Smart Radio, on-demand news, talk, and more on your mobile phone. The latest episode is always available for you. No syncing needed and no memory or storage wasted. Available for your iPhone, Android phone, webOS phones, or your BlackBerry. Downloading is easy, just go to Stitcher or check out your app store. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio.
And you may ask yourself,
how did I get here? And now here is your host, I'm Howdy.
Hello, hi, I'm Johnny. I'm your host. I'm really happy to be here. It's really early in the morning, the day that I'm putting this podcast out, because I'm a little bit behind. I've been suffering from allergies kind of terribly. And this show is a show about conversations between people. And sometimes they come here to my apartment. Sometimes I go to where they are. Or sometimes we meet in a neutral zone. And so today's was done in a neutral zone. But let me go back. Before we get into that, let me tell you, I think I attended my last pool party for the year, you guys. I went pretty hungover because I was in a wedding on Sunday. I was in a wedding, and then I played a little bit at the wedding. Then I innocently went home, and then I got a call from friends downtown who said, did you leave? And I said, yes. It was like 11. I'd made my escape, a phantom exit. I'd say goodbye maybe to one person. I don't know who it was. Anyway, so I jumped in a cab, and I went home with my gear, and then the people said, hey, why don't you come back to downtown? It's still early. So I jumped back in a cab. I go downtown. We close down the bars. I go back to this hotel because a friend of mine's going to give me a ride home. And lo and behold, I see the groom's parents standing outside of the hotel, still tuxedoed and gowned. Mom and dad, brother, Todd, they invite me up to the room. It's the room where LBJ awaited the poll results in 1964 in the Driscoll, the LBJ room. So I went there and I had 73,000-year-old whiskey. I don't know how old it was. But to me, it's the oldest thing I ever had. There was a long speech that came before I drank the whiskey about the whiskey, but I had already had some cocktails, and I got lost in the whiskey story. Anyway, so I had this whiskey. Then I ended up there in this LBJ room with this dude's parents telling really inappropriate stories until 4 a.m. And then I bailed. And then the next morning, I got up. I returned the tuxedo. And in literally a wave of pain, massive wave of pain, I jump in my car and I head over to my friend Joe's for a pool party with him and my friend Katrina. Fantastic party. I met some people. I talked to a girl. She just walked up and she sat down and she said something about her therapist. And then immediately we went into therapy. It was like, what is your guy telling you? And she's like, oh, this is what's going on with me. I have these issues with this and that, and I want to take care of people, and what are yours? And I'm like, I have this attachment detachment thing. It's all fucking crazy. So we literally like had this just in a pool, living the dream. I got some new sunglasses. That's another thing that happened. I got the sunglasses that Mickey Rourke wears in Angel Heart. I got a thing about chickens, so now I walk around saying I've got a thing about chickens, and it makes me want to see the movie Angel Heart. So anyway, so I did go to a pool party. It was the last pool party of the year. It lasted a long time. I floated around. I had a hamburger, and then I had some enchiladas that were fabulous, made by my friend Katrina. She's in town from New York. And it was all around great. It was so great, I ended up staying at my friend Joe's house. So for the night, that's the kind of party it was. It was the best kind. So that's why I think it might be the end of the pool parties for the summer. Like, that was a great way to go out. So we're out now. And we got to find out what happens in the fall. What kind of parties can I go to? Or do you just lay dormant? Or lie dormant? I don't know. Anyway, my guest for episode 101 is Bob Schneider. He is a musician. He's from here in Austin. You probably have heard of him if you're listening to this podcast. He has been on the road for a long time. He has been on the road for We talked about this in the interview, a decade. Constantly around the United States, opening for people like the Dixie Chicks on his own tours. And he's kind of like an industry of his own, you know? There's people that make money off of working with him, and that's something to be said. He's created something for himself. He's created a world, like a Bob Schneider brand. He has other bands, offshoots of what he does, and they complement what he does. He's an extremely prolific writer and artist, just all around artist. He's always painting something. He's put out a couple of books. He's won 24 Austin Music Awards in the last decade. He's put out 11 albums. He records every single show he plays, and you can buy it at the end of the show, or you can buy it online. It's just all around, and he's a very entertaining guy, and he's a very nice guy. I've known him for a long time. We've never been super close, but I feel like I know him. And after yesterday, I went to go meet him at the Moody Theater where they filmed the ACL thing. He was doing a private show there. We went and met in a green room there. Actually, he rolled down his window as I was walking down the street, and he was like, "Hey, man." And that was him. And so then we went into the Moody Theater. We went to his green room, and we sat down and had a talk. And it started off with him playing me a song before I started the recorder. He played me a song his son had written, and they had recorded it together, which I thought was really amazing, because I think a lot of people, when they see him or think about him, don't really think about him as this really proud dad. And he was insistent that I listen to this thing on his phone. I mean, it was real, you know, he was extremely proud, and it was a really great song. Anyway, it was about space. And so we went into this, or he went into this space monologue. And anyway, here it is. This is my conversation with my friend Bob Schneider. I hope you get something out of it. I really enjoyed it. Let's get down.
Well, I got some flowers coming in. Got some friends, I'll call me Jim. But you can call me Honey Pie. Like you in life, yeah, yeah. I'm the real thing, oh baby.
Once more, as for the penis,
pee hole.
Yeah. As for the pee hole mic covers, little penis mic covers. You know, I vowed to bring two headphones.
But
I forgot the other ones.
But you forgot.
Yeah, and the connector. So,
I feel like I've got. No, I don't. I thought I had some headphones. I don't.
But there's just one out on this. You're just going to have to do this straight up.
All right. I don't care.
So, the Earth is just in the middle of outer space.
Outer space is where the Earth is.
Yeah, outer space is where the Earth is. Does that freak you out?
Yeah, it does completely freak me out. Except I'm completely aware. I've had this... I don't know, epiphany, I guess, is the word. Recently, sometime in the last year, where I'm just logically, I came to the conclusion that none of this can exist. I mean, we're having an experience for sure that is very real to us. Like, it seems very real. There's no way to escape the realness of this experience.
But at the same time.
Well, it just dawned on me that you cannot have... Like, this, all of this can't exist, because if the universe existed, like if the Earth and people and then all the stars and all the millions and billions and trillions of galaxies of endless space existed, you'd have to have a place to put that in.
Yeah.
And if you had a place to put that in, you'd have to have a place to put that in. And it's too much. It's too big.
Way too much. It's like too vast of a thought to even get through.
Well, it's not even too vast of a thought. It can't be, because it keeps building on itself. Every time you find a place to put it in, you have to have another place to put it in. Right. It's like the Russian dolls.
The baby dolls.
It's similar to, and the only way I can really describe it to people is like when you look at a TV, let's say you're watching a show about the Grand Canyon on your TV.
Right.
the Grand Canyon's not inside your TV. It's just the idea of the Grand Canyon.
Right.
And that's the way the universe is. And because I always had a problem with the idea, like somebody had always postulated there is no time.
Right.
Because there's no future, obviously.
Right.
That doesn't exist yet.
Right.
And there's no past because that's gone.
Right.
You can't like get any moment from the past and recreate it right now. Exactly the way it happened in the past. So that's gone. So there's only the one now.
Right.
But you're like, wait a minute. If there's only the now, which is, this is all logical thinking.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
If there's the one, there's only the now, what you and me are in this room right now. But right. Earlier today, I was somewhere else and you were somewhere else. And how could we be here in this room now and also in that other place now?
Yeah.
Because there's no past and no future. So you have to come up with an explanation for that. And the way we've come up, the explanation we've come up with as human beings is by saying, oh, it's later now. And there's this right. thing called time. And we're in the future now. And we were in the past before. And that's why we can be in two places at once. But that's only to explain the feeling that this is real and how that would work if we were actually mass, which right. we can't be, because we can't be in both of those places. And as we've proven earlier in this discussion,
so we're just energy?
There's no past and future. We don't know what it is.
Okay.
It's an idea, probably. It's probably an idea that we're having. We don't know how that idea, how we're experiencing that idea. We don't have any idea. Like, nobody knew about television 300 years ago.
Right.
You know, somebody said, oh, there's going to be these pictures. They're going to move and stuff. And they'd be like, that sounds sketchy to me.
Right.
And in 10 years, you'll be able to like look through your television because it'll all be 3D.
Right.
And you won't need glasses. You'll just look at it and it'll look 3D.
It'll be 3D.
Right. So eventually they'll have some, you know, we have no idea what this technology is that no. is our existence.
Yeah. Do you think it's at someone else's hands?
Absolutely.
Really?
I mean, all right, for instance, that television exists.
Right.
And logically, you would say, well, somebody created that television.
Right.
But somebody might say, no, that television developed itself over time. I don't think so.
Right. No, of course not.
Somebody made that television.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I don't know who made that television. It says, what does it say
Sony.
On there? It says Sony, but I don't know what Sony is. I know that Sony's a big company because
right.
I know a little bit
but
about Sony.
Know.
But I don't know who the head of Sony is, and I don't know what technicians built that, or I don't know the technology behind it. So I just say it's a Sony TV.
Right.
And so when I talk about life, I go, oh yeah, God created existence. But I don't know what God is. God is probably like Sony. It's probably a huge company that created this experience. But when man was coming up...
It would be awesome if it wasn't awesome.
I'm sure it is. Because yeah. when man was coming up with the idea of God 2,000, 3,000, 5,000, 10,000 years ago, right. when you wanted something, you just made it. Like, oh, yeah. I want a bow, so you make a bow.
Right.
I want a dress, so I'm going to make a dress.
Right.
And they had a lot of cross-dressers back then.
Did they?
Well, they didn't know they were cross-dressing.
Because
right, right. they didn't know a lot about fashion back then.
Yeah, it was like a unisex.
Right. But when they were creating outfit. The creation myths, there was like one person, you just make something.
Right.
It wasn't like a bunch of people got together and made something.
Right.
So when they were talking about the universe getting made, it was just like, oh yeah, that's the way it's made. One person makes it. If they were coming up with it today, they would say, oh yeah, it's a big company that's making the universe.
Right.
McDonald's. Because it takes a lot to make that TV. One guy's not handcrafting that TV in his garage.
Right.
I mean, that would be cool.
Yeah, that would be cool.
But
he's
not. It's
not happening. And he's not making it because he wants to watch TV, which is what you're saying. Because it was like if you wanted a bow or you needed a bow out of necessity, you would make it yourself.
Exactly.
Right.
Right.
So he didn't make that for himself anyway. He bought it. He made it to... whoever the people were.
Sony made that to make some money
yeah.
to sell to people.
Yeah, a lot of money.
Right. And so we probably paid to be here.
Yeah.
To have this existence, to have this experience, because it's awesome. It's a great experience that we're having.
Yeah. It is. Did you study philosophy in college?
I sure did.
Did you? Did you finish college? Did you graduate from college?
I did not. I went 3.5 semesters. I ended up with a 1.8 GPA. And I think I had enough credits to be considered a freshman after 3.5 years.
So before that, you were in Germany and you went to El Paso. What is that choice? How do you do that?
Well, that happen? I went to a college in Germany for 2 years.
Oh, okay.
That was a blast. But it was only a 2-year school. And I was doing a lot of partying there. And
what,
so
what was the major? What was your
The major was art. I was going to be an artist.
Okay.
But they it was just a 2-year associate's degree. It was a branch of the University of Maryland. So I took all the art courses that you could. And then I took a bunch of other classes that I didn't attend.
Right.
And then I partied a lot. And so after that I was like, well, I'm not really doing much in school, so I'll take a year off. I took a year off, lived at home. And then after that, I was ready to get the fuck out and go back to school. And so I looked around and decided I wanted to go to CalArts in Valencia, California, and just applied to that one school, didn't apply anywhere else, and didn't get accepted. Oh. And my mom, unbeknownst to me, as a stopgap to get me the fuck out of the house,
right.
Had...
You're not an only child, are you?
No, I have a sister.
Younger?
Younger.
So she was still there and you were kind of...
No, she was in school. She was out.
But you were just driving them nuts.
No, I wasn't driving them nuts, but I think she just didn't want me out of the house. I mean, I was bagging groceries and going out and partying every night until like noon.
Right.
And then going and bagging groceries. So I don't think she wanted me to continue doing that for another year.
Right, right.
So she applied for me to go to UT El Paso. So that's where I ended up. Because it was too late to apply anywhere else.
Is it easy to get in there or something? Is that why she did that?
I think anybody who applies to UTEP gets in.
Right.
I'm assuming.
So what kind of culture shock happens when you... What, like, did you live in big city in Germany? Where'd you live?
I was living in Bremerhaven, which is a fairly decent-sized city. And I'd lived in El Paso for 4 years when I was a kid. Oh, okay. So I was familiar with it. The school was a bit of a culture shock because I'd gone to... this really small school in Munich, Germany, where nobody knew anybody. So everybody made fast friends there. UTEP was a completely different situation where it kind of, if you were going to UTEP, you were probably from El Paso and you already had your friends. You'd grown up with them. So it was really hard to make friends there. And the only friends I had when I was living in El Paso were these Arab guys that lived in the apartment where I lived. And they were all at UTEP studying engineering. I guess there was a lot of people come here from, a lot of people come to the States, get engineering degrees, and then go back to their country. Right. So I hung out with those guys. Interesting group of dudes, for sure. The first night that I was in this apartment, my parents kind of just dropped me off and then split. And that night, there were all these sirens going off and, you know, police lights. And I look out my window, and there's a big commotion going on across the courtyard. And I meet these guys a couple days later and I'm talking to them and I'm like, what happened a couple nights ago? The first night that I was here, there was a lot of siren activity and police and ambulance and stuff. And they're like, well, we met this girl probably at a strip club. I can't remember. She came home. She was super wasted. They lived on the third floor of this apartment complex and they were all partying. These guys did nothing but drink every day. So we got along great. Anyways, this girl was leaning against the balcony and just fell over the balcony and landed 3 stories down on this gravel path or like gravel pit or whatever.
Oh, no.
And they, I know, they freaked out. They went down there. My friend Asham went down there and her eyes were open and he was just like, oh, she's dead now. Because that was a death fall. And so they call the police, they call the ambulance, they come. And like after 2 minutes or 3 minutes of being just lying there with her eyes open, supposedly dead, she just jumped up and started running down the street. So she didn't die.
It was one of those things where you're so wasted that you can actually take the fall.
Who knows? But that was the first, those were the guys that I hung out with for a year and a half.
Were you playing music at all or were you...
Well, while I was there, I met the Nirala brothers, Salim and Ferris, Nirala and started playing in a band with them called the Crying Dimes. I was their keyboard player. And they were talking about moving to Austin and playing music. And I'd heard about Austin because I was reading Spin Magazine. It had just come out at that point. And they had an article about the Butthole Surfers and another article about the True Believers. And they were talking about Austin. It just sounded like a cool place.
Right.
But I was like, ah, I got to finish school, get my degree, whatever. But I wasn't hardly going to school. I was just basically taking fine art courses and
right.
and hanging out mostly in Juarez every night and not getting a lot done.
Did you ever see the Donkey Show? I've never seen the Donkey Show.
I have a vague... No, I didn't. I eventually ended up, once I moved to Austin, going to Laredo and going to Boys Town and seeing a Donkey Show.
Is that horrifying? Or...
Yeah, it's horrifying. I mean, I didn't see a donkey actually have sex with a woman.
But
I
they
just
bring
saw
a donkey out, and that's terrifying enough.
I remember a donkey coming out and me leaving or something. I don't want to see anything with a donkey.
Right, right, yeah.
It just doesn't do anything for me.
Right.
So they were talking about moving to Austin, and I was like, I don't know. And then I went home for a Christmas break back to Germany, and while I was there, I decided, fuck it. I'm going to move to Austin and try music and see what happens. I'll try it for a couple of years. And then if it doesn't work out, I'll go back to school, finish school.
Right.
So I got back and told those guys they had already enrolled in school for another semester. So they didn't want to go. So I just came on my own. I had $300 in my pocket and I knew one girl who lived here, a girl named Cha-Cha. And she let me stay in her house.
Met her at Juarez.
No, she was from El Paso. And she let me, she was like, you got 4 days, but you have to be out of my, because she knew me.
Right.
She knew if she didn't like put a limit, I'd right, be there right. for, I'd still be living there.
Sounds
with
like an
Cha-Cha.
Adam Temple rule.
20 years later. Yeah. It's like the Adam Temple rule. Yeah. So I had 4 days to find an apartment and a job and get situated, which I did. In 4 days, I found a place that would let me move in for half of the first month's rent and no deposit. And, which I think was like $130 or something. I think it was $260 a month.
Wow.
For a little efficiency right in yeah. West Campus. And then I got a job at Mr. Gaddy's. And 3 days later, I was king of the world.
Yeah.
Loved it.
Living it. So what was the first band that you had when you lived here? Was it Joe Rockhead or was it?
No, I started looking in the musician's referral in the Chronicle.
Right.
I didn't know anybody. So I looked in there and you run across some characters. I ended up in a band with some guys and I forget what we're called. Maybe the Deadbeats. I can't remember. We had a few practices and then we had a gig in somebody's living room.
Right.
And we show up and the bass player doesn't show up. So we just play without him for an hour.
Right, right.
And we finish our set and right when we finish, this guy comes walking in. And he's a crack addict. And we're like, hey, where were you at? And he was like, I was like smoking crack or whatever. And then I remember him going into the bathroom. And I'm like, what are you doing in here? He's like, I'm smoking crack. And I'd never tried crack before. And I was like, right. Dude, let me try some crack. And he's like, okay, I'll let you try some crack. And so he starts smoking this crack. And he decides that he doesn't have enough crack for both of us.
Right,
so,
he's a crackhead, right?
He's a crackhead.
They're not known for sharing.
So he wouldn't let me have it. He was like, I don't have enough. And that was really my closest time I ever got to smoking crack. I've never smoked crack.
I've never smoked crack either.
It's probably a good thing.
Yeah.
We'd
be having this conversation in a different place.
Maybe. I don't know. I know a lot of guys that smoke crack.
I know guys that have smoked crack.
Right. And they don't smoke it anymore. No. So I'm sure we wouldn't have smoked crack for very long.
No. Or lifers. Yeah. So you, how long did the Deadbeats or whatever last?
That was the only, I mean, I never played with those guys again.
Yeah.
That was horrible.
It's weird because the only time that, well, I guess the first time I ever knew what meth was answering an ad in a paper and going to someone's thing to audition for them, but in Houston. And it was like in this rec room of an apartment complex, and the guys were just fucking weird. And it was weird because in 1 week, I went and auditioned for two different bands, and they both had me audition to Golden Earrings, Twilight Zone. The same song, which I thought was... And it was like, you know, 6 years after the song was popular.
Right. And they were all on meth.
All on meth.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. So what'd you end up doing? How'd you end up meeting guys? Did you go out and...
Well, I kept playing with different guys. I think there was a guy in that first band, Curtis Mackler, and he started jamming with some guys that I kind of knew from just hanging out. Like, I was just hanging out. I lived at a co-op. I was working at Texas Textbooks, but I was going to a lot of parties, and I'd meet a lot of people, and there'd be jams late at night, and I met a guy, Bruce Salmon, and Curtis D., and I met a guy that I knew his brother back in El Paso, this guy, Robert Thayer. Anyways, these guys started jamming together. I forget what they called themselves. They had a horrible name. And I remember one time I got invited over there to watch them jam, and was blown away. I thought what they were doing was really cool, and I kind of begged them to let me play in there, like just sit in with them.
Right.
And
what kind of music, what was your thing then? Did you have a thing like, oh, I'm a, you know,
well,
punk rock guy, or I'm a...
Well, the type of music that most closely resembled would be kind of like Chili Peppers and right. Fishbone.
Right.
That band ended up becoming Joe Rockhead after I kind of started playing with them. It was one of those things where we didn't really have a name, and then they back in those days they had the Austin Chronicle would have this list of all... Oh no, it was South by Southwest.
Okay.
And we auditioned for South by Southwest, got in, and then we had to give them a name for the band. Maybe that's what it was.
Okay.
Or maybe it was just, didn't they have a listing in the Chronicle every year of bands? Listing.
Yeah.
It was just that. It was the band listing.
Yeah.
That the deadline was like the next day, so we had to come up with a name.
It's funny because you would have like, what's going to happen to me if I don't get my name in the fucking listing?
Like, exactly. It's
gotta, like, who right. fucking even cares?
Yeah, who cares? But we really did care.
Right, right, yeah.
And so we were like trying to figure out a name, and then Bruce Salmon came up with that Joe Rockhead. I guess I didn't know it came from Flintstones.
Right, right.
But there's a character on there. Right. Character. Oh, no. There's a character named Joe Rockhead.
Was it the rock star?
No, Joe Rockhead, I think, was like owned like a construction company or something.
Okay.
Anyways, so I liked the name. We put that in the listing, and then we started playing. I was in a few bands before that.
What were you doing? Were you the singer of them, or were you?
I was the singer. Okay. And we were playing here and there, and around that time, this was like in 1990, I guess. We started playing in 89, but around 1990, Soul Hat was doing really well down at the Black Hat. Two Hoots and a Holler would play Monday night. Soul Hat would play maybe on Tuesdays or Thursdays or something, and they were packing that place. So the idea was like, oh, we got to get into the Black Cat. So we ended up getting a residency there on Tuesday nights.
But wait.
What?
Give me your Paul Sessom story. Like, did he say anything
Paul Sessom's
when he first hired you?
No, I don't remember anything about first meeting Paul Sessom's. No. I feel like I've always known him somehow. I'm sure I was hanging out down there before then and had met him. I don't know how I met him. I do have the feeling that he always liked me.
Like, yeah.
I don't know why. Maybe because I was so crazy and messed up then that maybe he had an affinity for me or something. Or
I remember it wasn't, I mean, it might have been like a year later, like in 1991. I still lived in Houston, and I went to say hey to a friend of mine that ran sound there, and you guys were sound checking, and I watched your sound check, and for some reason I remembered it because it was something you were doing, and I couldn't remember it, but I've always equated you with having this sort of like Kaufman-esque sense of humor that... Unless you get the fact that whatever it is that you're doing is actually really funny,
right.
It would really annoy some people.
Oh, yeah.
But I think that's what makes you really happy. And I think that's the very first thing I ever got. And that was just literally just watching you sound check from across the room. And I saw your show that night.
Well, I like
the band.
Yeah, I mean, that band was, it was definitely a live.
It wasn't Steve, though, playing bass. It was an older guy. I remember that.
Well, no, it was Steve.
It was Steve?
Steve Bernal was the bass player by 91. When it started out, it was Bruce Salmon and Curtis Mackler were taking turns playing bass and guitar. Okay. But eventually, Curtis either quit the band or got kicked out of the band. I can't remember which. And then Steve Bernal started playing full time. So when you saw us at the Black Cat, Steve Bernal was playing bass.
Right.
And we started playing there, I want to say.
No, I saw you at Fitzgerald's.
Okay.
Then it might have a year, like in 91. It was right before I moved here because I was already moving here. Because I remember that's, I think, why I remembered. Y'all go see those guys.
Maybe in 90, maybe it was Curtis or Bruce playing. I don't know.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Anyways, by the time we got to Black Cat, though, the band was pretty much formed. We started doing this gig, and I want to say in the September of 90, and then there was this incident that happened on Mardi Gras. When is that? Like March or
February or something.
February,
yeah.
And it was Fat Tuesday because we played Tuesday night was our night to play there. And we had started drawing a pretty good crowd. We were getting like maybe 200 people coming out every week to see us play. And so the place was pretty packed. I mean, it really only held maybe 250 people.
Yeah.
And I remember Matthew Sweet was there and his girlfriend. And at some point, somebody was fucking with Matthew Sweet and she maced the person that was fucking with him. And so I'm on stage performing and all of a sudden it feels like I've just like inhaled glass.
Oh, so you got some too.
And I start coughing and I look around, everybody in the club is coughing like crazy. And so we realized, oh, there's something in the air. So the club clears out, half the people leave, they go home, half the people stay, we finish the set. But at some point within like 30 minutes after we started, there was six or seven naked people on stage. A couple guys, mostly girls.
Right.
And it kind of stayed that way for the rest of the night. And from that week, I don't know if the story got out or whatever,
but
from that night forward, it was never less than 500 or 600 people in there.
And it was mayhem.
And we eventually started doing two nights a week, Tuesdays and Fridays. I've never had a job since then.
Right.
Just played music since then. Yeah. I mean,
it set you up. That was the band that kind of like set you up to be able to do the next thing, to do the next thing, to do the next thing.
It did. That was the beginning. Well, it allowed me to quit my job, and I've never had to actually have a real job since then.
How your shows were 4 hours, 5 hours? How long did you have to play? Because that was
about 3.5 hours. We would play.
I mean, that's long. What did you guys do for music? You didn't have. Did you make up a bunch of shit and everybody jammed?
No, we had 3 hours worth of music at that point. And we'd been playing for a couple of years at that point. So we had plenty of material. And we'd play longer. It was 11 to 2 was our gig time, but we'd usually play till 2:30. So about 3.5 hours.
Wow. That didn't, your voice handled it? You never had to take voice? You never ran?
There were no monitors at the Black Cat.
Right, yeah.
No, I would scream. I would lose my voice.
Yeah. I mean, and you sing almost every day. You know, still.
Yeah, but I don't do what I did back in those days.
Right.
That was mostly anger. It was like channeled anger is really what that was.
Were you angry? That's what it was?
Super, super angry.
What were you angry about?
Everything.
Do you know? Like what? Your own life?
You name it.
UTEP?
Everything. Anything you could name one thing and I was angry about
Okay,
it.
You were mad at your parents.
Super mad at my parents
and at
God and life and everybody in it. Nobody was doing what I wanted them to do.
What was it? What were you looking for? What did you want? You just wanted them to go with the Bob flow.
I wanted people to be smarter and to do what I wanted them to do all the time, and they just didn't do that. And so, so the best thing for me to do was to either be playing music or be really wasted.
Right.
And the idea was to play music, get real famous, and then die at 27. That was the plan.
You fucked that up.
I lived. I outlived my dreams. Right. Well, I remember when I was 29, I was like, man, if I die now, nobody's going to care.
Yeah.
It's going to, I can't die. And so I ended up getting sober when I was 29.
That's when you did. Yeah. So that's the thing that I've always gotten about you is that, knowing you from before you were sober, I don't know you that well, but I've known you for a long time, like almost 20 years. And there's a, you definitely get the, idle hands are the devil's work with you. You are.
Oh yeah. I don't do nothing. I don't know people that can do that.
Right.
That's crazy.
Yeah. But it's almost like a manic work ethic with you.
Oh, it's absolutely. Like, it's dissociating.
Yeah.
I found that the best way for me to not have to feel anything or, you know,
have literally workaholic
deal with my anxiety is to like write songs or work or, I mean, there are other things you can do. You can, you know, watch movies or have sex or eat or whatever. But I found a lot of enjoyment in being productive and writing and recording and making art and whatever. But I've always done that. I mean, I was really, you know, very sensitive. And I mean, I grew up in like an alcoholic family. So it was pretty scary for me as a kid. I was very scared as a kid. And I found I found that if I drew that, like, I could like escape into this little world that I could control and it would shut out the rest of the world. So I've kind of always done it my whole life. I've kind of escaped reality by creating.
Right.
So
it kind of pisses me off because I had the same kind of thing. I just don't draw as well as you now.
Well, I think a lot of people, I think most artists have it. Because if you can socialize and if you like life and are engaged in it, it doesn't leave you a lot of time to do your art and to get good at it.
It's true.
So, you know, you find a lot of people that are really, that make beautiful art tend to be really not horrible people in the sense that they're a horrible person. They're just not. But
probably not as good of a time as you think
they are. They're just not good at living their lives very well. Like, I have a hard time enjoying my life. I have a great life.
Yeah.
A wonderful career, beautiful son, great relationships with people. I have a hard time enjoying it.
Yeah.
So
that's normal. You're uncomfortable.
I'm uncomfortable.
Yeah. You're comfortable, but you seem comfortable on stage because there is your environment that everything is under your,
right?
Like that's your domain.
Right.
Like
I have
the
free
reign of the stage.
Right. I have free reign on stage. On stage, I feel like whatever I say or do is allowed. Like, I don't have to watch my language. I don't have to, you know, worry about what anybody thinks, or which is weird because most people would think that that's the opposite. But it's actually
same, I have that same thing. I have an what I find, I'm shockingly more comfortable standing and being the focal point and being physically removed a little bit from people than I do kind of being a guy at a party.
Right. Well, because there's consequences at the party. Right,
exactly.
Like, what do these people think about me? How am I supposed to act?
Right.
What am I supposed to say in this situation?
Right.
I feel like the goddamn Terminator.
Yeah.
Where he's like looking at the answers on the side.
Yeah,
like, how are you doing?
Yeah.
How does a human stand in this situation?
Yeah.
Do you respond with a smile and a wink? I don't know what the fuck to do. And it's only recently that I've even become aware of this. Like, now I really try to like go out of my way to like smile and let people know that I'm hearing them talk.
Right.
Whereas before I would just stand there, look at them blankly.
Yeah.
I would be computing what they were saying. They would be talking to me. I'd be listening intently. I'd be feeling things. Yeah. I'd be even answering their questions, but none of it would be in the physical world. It would all be in my head.
Right.
And then they would go, what is wrong with this dude? Why is this guy such a dick? Because I'm talking to him, but he's obviously ignoring me.
Right.
And he wants nothing to do with me, and he hates me, and I think he's just an aloof prick. And so now I've just recently become aware of this, and so now I go, I try to smile at people and let them know I'm listening to you. Yeah. I understand that you're talking to me. And I still don't know how to respond appropriately, but
it's so funny.
At least I'm allowing, you know what I mean? At least I'm aware of what's going on to some degree.
Right. I think it's funny because that people have such a misconception of what is actually going on with artists and people that they, you know, kind of look admire, because at some point you're on the side of a bus and people like they, you know, I'm going to see Bob, like they don't even use your last name, like, you know, you're going to see, you know, like it's this dude, but it this dude's totally freaking out.
Oh yeah,
even though he's the life of the party.
Well, that's the other thing too. I mean, I've been sober for 17 years.
Yeah.
And my crowd is a heavy drinking, smoking.
Yeah, they're having a...
They are partying.
Yeah, they are partying.
I mean, there's... It's rare that somebody doesn't offer to smoke me up after a show or let me buy you a drink or whatever. Right, and right. I tell them, I'm like, well, I haven't had any drugs or a drink in 17 years. And they don't know... They have no idea how to even react to it because they have an idea of who I am.
Yeah.
That has nothing to do with how I conduct myself in real life. In real life, I'm very... Like, the most important thing to me is being a dad.
Right.
And, you know, being a responsible person and just, you know, living... I live a very normal...
Grown-up life.
Semi-grown-up.
Yeah. You still...
Semi-dysfunctional.
Yeah.
Semi-filled with despair, lonely life.
Everyone.
With wonderful moments where I get to... be in front of people and perform, which I love to do.
Yeah.
And I get to create stuff, which I love.
Yeah.
I find a lot of satisfaction in that. But it's not, I don't think it's what people think my life should look like.
Well, let's go back to the crazy Joe Rockhead days.
All right,
you guys are ruling the Black Cat and you start touring around. You guys toured all, we all were kind of like on this circuit of Midwest, Colorado, kind of Texas, Louisiana thing.
We would tour in Colorado and Texas, and that was it.
Oh, yeah.
Every time we'd go somewhere else, we didn't have any success.
Yeah.
Like, we tried to go to Little Rock and Fayetteville, Baton Rouge, New Orleans, but with very little success. We had a little bit of success in Colorado, a little bit of success in Austin, but that was about it. And then the band broke up in 93.
Yeah.
And then started playing with the Ugly Americans. We got signed with Capricorn Records. Went out to L.A. to make a record.
It was a bleed over you guys had. Didn't you guys... you had the Ugly Americans while you were still doing Joe Rockhead, right?
Right. Well, the thing about Joe Rockhead was I would have to be sober during the day. Like, I couldn't be drunk to play that gig.
Right.
And... But I knew some other guys. I'd met some other guys that I was, and we would just, I would party with these guys, and they had a band called the Atlantics or the Atlantic Soul Review.
Right.
And so I would sit in with those guys and I'd be wasted, and they're all, half of those guys have gotten sober and stuff. Right, they're a hard partying bunch. And so I was playing with those guys, and we recorded a record with the Ugly Americans while Joe Rockhead was still together. But, yeah, when Joe Rockhead broke up, I was kind of already playing with the Ugly Americans.
Right, I remember that.
And the only difference was I could be drunk with the Ugly Americans. And so from 93 to 95, which is when I quit drinking, I was never not drunk.
Right.
So it went from like, I'll start drinking at 2 o'clock in the morning to I'll start drinking at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Right. Yeah.
But I'm not going to stop.
Right.
It's the 24 hour. Yeah, it was.
So what made you stop? I mean, was it people around you? Were they like,
hey? I think the bottom line for me was, cause I've always been so like, I know it sounds paradoxical because I really act like I don't give a shit about what people think about me, but really one of my biggest concerns is how people perceive me. And, everybody, you know, I just think everybody thought of me as like this drunk, obnoxious guy that they didn't want to be around.
I thought of you as drunk and funny, I'll be honest. There were some times I didn't want to be around you, but I will say there were a lot of times that I remember being doubled over with laughter at just the way you walked into a room, because it was just crazy.
It was crazy.
And I knew crazy shit. And I'm sorry. And I'm not that I'm encouraging you.
No.
I want you to be like that. I'm very glad you're
Well, it was the
happy.
90s, too. Yeah. If we look at photos for the 90s.
What you were wearing was probably what I was laughing
well,
at.
Well, we were all wearing. Mr. Rocket Baby was.
In a top hat while I was laughing.
I would like to take a look at some of those Mr. Rocket Baby photos.
They're out there.
But not too much different than probably the Joe Rockhead pics. I mean, there was a lot of.
We both wore top hats.
Those, when there was, did you buy the hats from the girl who made them in town?
I think so. Somebody gave me hats. That's how I ended up with the hats.
Well, there was a girl in town that would make these like big vinyl, cat in the hat.
The same girl. Yeah.
And I think you guys all wear those hats. I know I had a bunch of those hats.
Right.
That was that time.
So you got sober because you were realizing that you were just kind of a pain in the ass and like a.
Well, I really didn't like to be hungover, and the hungovers, I mean, my hangovers were really bad. I was really, truly scared because I was, especially that last 2 years, when you don't stop drinking, you're in blackout most of the time. So I'd spend half the time in a blackout, and I'd wake up the next day really hungover and just scared to death because I didn't know what I'd done for half the night, you know, and I'd been wandering around doing who knows what.
Right.
And it started to get to the point where I wasn't suicidal, but I was so despairing. Like I was so like, I just felt so doomed to spend the rest of my life in this sort of really scared, you know,
dark place,
really scared, really in a lot of pain from these hangovers. And, like I was just going to end up doing that for the rest of my life. So I started having this idea, well, like I can kill myself. And really that was the thing that kind of kept me going. It was like, well, I can get through today because I can always kill myself at any point. And so like that was really the only thing that kind of kept me afloat, really. And so it got really bad. And then, we went out to LA we got signed with Ugly Americans. I mean, one of the cool things about being fucked up is you can play music and get away with it.
Yeah.
Like you don't have to be sober to make music.
Yeah.
In fact, my favorite musicians were people that were really fucked up.
Yeah.
On heavy drugs. And I never got into heavy drugs, but you know, all my favorite guys did. So, it got really bad, and I would try to quit occasionally, like towards the end. I was like, I'm just gonna like not drink for a week, and I couldn't do it. I couldn't not drink for a whole day.
Physically, as well.
No,
was just there physical, kind of like shaking and like
I just didn't just
mentally.
I just couldn't do it. I would at some point break down and start drinking. So it got really bad. And then I just got lucky. A friend of mine had been sober for a while out in LA. And so I was hanging out with him. He had been sober for 5 years. And he was like, hey, if you want to go to AA, that might be a way to go. And I was like, yeah, I'm not going to AA. That sounds horrible.
Yeah.
You have to quit drinking.
Right.
So that was out.
Yeah.
And then I went to some parties. I got in some sticky situations out in LA. I almost got beat up one night. Then I messed with some mafia folks, which is real scary. And so I was like, I'm going to quit drinking for a while, for 6 months. I'll go to AA. I'll quit drinking for 6 months. And a day later, my band had an intervention, sent me to a rehab, and haven't had a drink since.
So it worked. It's all working good. So I'm just checking the battery level. I like to do that. So how long were you in rehab? Like 6 weeks?
No, it was, 4 weeks.
4 weeks.
28 days. And
what was that like for you? I mean, like in the position you were in, were you grateful to be there after a couple of days? Or?
Well, I had an idea that rehab was going to be like the Betty Ford Clinic, or, you know, there was going to be, hey, what's up?
Hi. Hey, Connor.
That it was going to be like, you know, there were going to be celebrities there, some hot chicks, and I'd like, you know,
maybe have a good
meet
time.
An actress.
Yeah.
build up some, you know, make fast friends with Jack Nicholson. And,
right.
And it was going to be great. And I'll write some songs. Be great.
Yeah.
Dry out for a month. Have a great time. But it wasn't anything like that.
It's a lot of work, personal work.
Well, there was no celebrities there. It was just like, you know, broken housewives and these like, it was in Colorado, these like Colorado hippies and nobody cool at right. all. I mean, I was like, what am I doing here with these people? I have nothing. Right. I'm like a superstar.
Right.
I'm a rock
you
and roll.
Guys don't understand.
I'm a rock and roll superstar. And I'm like, you know, right. they've put me with these normal, like yeah. not even normal people, but like people that have really like broken old right. housewives and stuff. What am I doing
people
here?
People that hit bottom.
Yeah. So it was weird. But after a month, you know, I learned a lot and, you know, made really bonded, you know, really bonded and related to these people. And
yeah.
It completely changed my whole perspective on everything. So
that's good.
Yeah.
Then you went back and you made a record then, or did you make the record before you were sober?
The record was done
okay.
at that point. And so, but the thing that happened was I got out of rehab and went back and realized this band I was in that was signed, Ugly Americans.
Right.
It was a great band with a lot of great players. I didn't like the music at all. In fact, I didn't like anything about it. It wasn't what I wanted to do, or it wasn't where my heart was at all.
Right.
So I started a band called The Scabs yeah. with my friend Adam Temple, who was living at my house at the time, which was more of what I wanted to do. It was
yeah.
kind of all over the place, super eclectic, super like some of it was, you know, very schmaltzy. And like we would do like Neil Sedaka covers, yeah. but then we'd also do like, I think the first song we wrote was I Fucked Your Daughter in the Ass Boy.
Yeah.
So it was all over the map.
Yeah.
Thematically, some of it was super silly. Some of it was very serious.
Yeah.
Some of it you could dance to. It was more like art rock.
I loved it when that band, when you started that band, it was, I loved it.
Yeah. It definitely felt freeing and creative and it felt like art to me.
Yeah.
Whereas the Ugly Americans was more like music as commerce.
Right.
It was a thing. And I was trying to bring some of these songs into the Ugly Americans and say, hey, I want to do some stuff that's sillier and more arty. And they didn't want to do that at all.
Right.
But we were signed, so I kept playing with that band. But
right.
I really subjected them to a lot of...
There's a way you... I mean, there's a time you could definitely tell just as someone that's seen you that your heart wasn't in that and your heart was in the Scabs. And
for sure.
Kind of there doing, yeah. you know... So you built up the Scabs, and then how long was it before you started playing on your own?
Well, Scabs started in 95, and it was a good year before we had built up a following with that band. Right. And the thing that we discovered with the Scabs was less of the sort of super arty, weird, Satan Stole My Tampon songs,
right.
and the more like straight-ahead sort of James Brown stuff we did,
right?
The more like... hot girls would want to come to the club and dance.
Right.
So within about a year and a half, it had turned into a kind of a dance party.
Yeah.
I mean, we still did a little bit of the yeah. art rock stuff, but mainly it was just a party.
Yeah.
And so it started packing pretty seriously. And we eventually moved from Steamboat to Antone's and started a residency at Antone's, which lasted until about 98. I think it was in 1998, I wrote a song called 2002, which mm-hmm. was a real mellow, sad song. And I started doing that in the Scabs. So we'd be having this dance party, and then all of a sudden, it would just stop. And it'd right. be like, the year's 2002. I'm doing exactly what I want to do. And then people would be like, what is this shit?
Right, right.
So I was like, well, I want to do something where I can play this sort of introspective singer-songwriter stuff that I've... And I'd written some other songs like it. So by 98, I started playing solo with a band, but the singer-songwriter stuff I did at Stubbs.
At Stubbs, yeah. With Leffler.
With Bill Leffler, yeah. was playing drums and...
I think it was Bruce.
I think Bruce... I don't think Bruton was playing yet. It was Bruce was playing bass.
Boyle?
Not Boyle. This guy, Andrew Carver.
Oh, yeah.
Was playing with me. And then... We did that for a couple months and ran it into the ground. Nobody was coming out to see it.
I remember going to see it. No one was there.
Nobody was there. And then we moved it over to Steamboat. We were doing it Sunday night. So same thing. Like the first couple times we played, there was 40 or 50 people there. By the end, there was maybe 7 or 8. And so after 3 or 4 months, stopped doing it. I was like, that's it. I'm done with the solo stuff.
Yeah.
I'll just keep playing in bands, scabs. You know, I'll do that. But then I went and saw The Resentments, which Stephen Rootin was in.
Right.
And John D. Graham at the Saxon Pub, and saw that, and I was like, this is kind of what I want to do, and it works in this club. So I went to Joe Abels, who owned Saxon Pub, and I asked him what his worst night was, and he said Monday night's the worst night of the week. And I was like, well, let me have 8:30 to 10:30 on Monday nights. I want to try to do, you know, do sort of this Resentment thing. So we started doing that, and that was in, I guess it was 98, end of 98, beginning of 99, and started playing there, and have been doing it now for goddamn 13 years.
I know. So were you this prolific, like in Joe Rockhead and in The Ugly Americans, as you are now? I mean, you write so many songs. Well, were you doing it back then like you are now? Or did you have this 2-hour show that you needed to write a bunch of songs for or anything like that?
Well, I mean, I've always just been real creative, and just, I've always had an active imagination, and
right.
and I've felt comfortable with just saying or doing whatever in that sort of creative environment. So, with Joe Rocket, every time we'd get together and get in a room, we'd write three or four songs. And we were, you know, we'd get together once or twice a week. So,
yeah.
I mean, most of it's horrible. But I didn't care. Like, I've never really cared. And I've always had this idea that I think I must have gotten from my parents that I'm really good at this.
Right.
And I've always thought I was good. Like, right. Every step of the way, like, I've always, like...
Even when you weren't.
I've never been good. That's the thing. Right. I'm still not good.
Right.
I really not. And, but even now... Like, I go, no, I'm good. I'm as good as anybody.
Right.
Like, I'm as good as any motherfucker on the planet. Right. I will go toe-to-toe with any songwriter that's living. Put me in a room with Paul Simon, and I'll take up a guitar, and I'll blow that motherfucker out the door, because I have enough songs now that I've collected.
Right.
I've written, 2,000 songs, and I can fucking play 60 of them that will fuck this guy up.
Right.
But I'm not that good. I've never been good. But I've always felt that I am.
Right.
And it's given me the ability to just keep creating.
Yeah.
And I think if you do it long enough, I mean, if you just write enough songs, you're eventually... It's like being a blind motherfucker shooting at a target.
Right.
Most of everything that I shoot is not even hitting the target, but occasionally I'll hit a bullseye.
Right.
Just because from sheer
repetition.
You do repetition,
it so much, yeah. Yeah.
From just doing it enough.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of people, I don't know about a lot of people. I don't know anything. This is just all in my head. I think people write me off or have written me off because they've seen me in the past, and they'll come see me play, and I play a lot of bullshit. And they're like, yeah, I saw a show. It was pretty bullshitty. There was a lot of bullshit there.
Right. It takes knowing you, though, kind of knowing you as an artist to get that when you come, you know.
Well, I think... If you were to come now, you would see, it's just, there's not a lot of room for the bullshit, unfortunately now.
Right.
Because most of the stuff is pretty good.
Yeah.
So I'll try playing new stuff all the time, but it doesn't last very long.
Right. So you did, is that, going back to when you were doing those shows, that's when you did the songs sung and played at the same time?
Yeah. Well, that was the first thing I did. I'd met Sandra Bullock around that time. Mm-hmm. She had come to a scab show, and she was filming a movie, and she was like, hey, I need a song for this movie that I'm doing, Gun Shy. So I was like, oh, I got a song for you.
Yeah.
And it was a song, Round and Round, that I'd written. And I had a sample of Pavarotti singing like over the chorus. And it turned out that her mom had, who was an opera singer, had sung an aria for the movie. And she, like, she was playing me the music for the movie. And I was like, oh, I think I can use that, a sample of that, for this other song I wrote called Round and Round. So we ended up recording that. And she actually produced it at this guy, Carl Thiel's studio.
Yeah.
And while I was there recording that, you know, I met Carl and he's like, hey, what, you know, play me some of your songs. And I'm like, all right, I'll play you some songs. And so I started playing him a couple songs. He's like, let's record those songs right now. I'm like, all right. So I just, he set up a mic and a, and just two mics, one on the guitar and one on the vocal. And I just sat there and played him, I don't know, 12 songs. And then we put out that record, Song Sung and Played on Guitar, at the same time. And I'd never done anything, I'd never put out anything with my name on it.
Yeah.
And I was scared to death.
Really?
Oh, absolutely. I was like, people are going to think this is horrible, right, or I don't know how they were going to react. So, right. So I put it out and then people were like, I wasn't killed. They didn't hate it. So,
do you have sound check it sometime soon?
Well, I don't need to be out there until about 3:15. What time is
it? It's like, 2:35.
Oh yeah. I got another half an hour.
Okay.
So yeah, so we put that out and then Carl liked it so much. He was like, why don't you come in and just record a record here? We'll do it for free. And then if we make some money later on, you can pay me later on. So I'd already started playing with Lonely Land at Saxon Pub.
Right.
So I got those guys, Stephen Bruton, Bruce Hughes, David Boyle, Mike Longoria. We went in there and recorded for, I don't know, maybe a week. And then Carl Thiel really spent, I don't know, a good month editing it, like really working on
putting it together
and put and finish that record. I want to say the last, like maybe December of 99. And I remember just getting a box of those CDs and take it down to Waterloo Records. And I really just wanted to get in that Waterloo top 10 that they have on the Austin Chronicle.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was like, well, I'll just sell them here at this one store. And then maybe that'll put me in the top 10. And it's weird because I remember when I took the box down there and I was talking to Martin, who was the record buyer down there, and I told him, because I'd taken some of the other records, the Song Sung and Played, to him earlier, year before or whatever, and I was like, I think we're going to sell some of these Lonely Land records. I just have a feeling. And so I gave him the box and we started selling them. And a couple things happened. The big thing was KJSR started playing, I think they were playing Round, and I think they started playing Round and Round, and they played it a ton. So they were playing that, and then I started dating Sandra Bullock. So because of that, I got some notoriety, and like I was in the paper a couple times, people were writing about it. And those two things sparked some interest, and then people started buying that record.
Right.
And it got in the top 10 at Waterloo, and then it went to number one. And then it stayed number one for 3 years.
Jesus.
It was crazy.
And so I think you like sold more records than anybody else there.
Yeah, we sold. Yeah.
More than the Beatles.
But more than more than like Pink Floyd. But but I only sold it out of that one record store.
Right.
So what ended up happening was, because I was selling so many records out of that one store, it started showing up on some weird independent record store chart. And that got into the scope, like it got on the radar of the people at Universal Records. And I started getting calls, and I'd like pick up the phone. Hello. Hi, this is Monty Lippman. I'm the president of Universal Records. I listen to your Lonely Land record. I like it. What's going on down there? I'm like, well, I don't know. I recorded the record about a year ago. I've been just taking boxes of it down to Waterloo Records, playing this Monday night show, Saxon Pub.
It's about it.
It's like, all right, well, let me know if I can do anything for you. All right. See you later. Click. And then a couple months later, he just kept calling me, like just checking in with me. Yeah. And then one time he called me, he's like, you know, I haven't listened to this Metal and Steel song. I think I can get it on the radio. Why don't you come up and visit? We'll talk about maybe putting it out on Universal Records. So I went up there, talked to him, liked him. And we put it out on Universal in beginning in 2001.
And everything changed.
No, everything stayed the same.
Exactly the same.
Everything just stayed exactly the same. They just put it out, same record. We changed the album cover because I had some weird art.
Right, right, right. And they put your face
that
on
it. That I had done. They were like, we want to put your face on it.
I remember going to my cousin's like 13th birthday party or 14th birthday party or something during that time.
And he had
this girl. No, there was a girl at the party that was just walking around and looking at the album. She had bought it.
Oh, really?
At the record store. And she was just walking around the party, like looking at your face. And then I was like, I know that guy. She was just like, no. It was
That's
awesome.
So weird.
Yeah.
I took that picture of my bathroom.
So then you toured a lot?
Well, the biggest thing that, I guess the biggest change was, like, everything stayed the same in Austin for me in terms of how I was doing.
Right.
But yeah. Nationally, I'd never toured, and they put about a half a million behind me in just marketing. So they did get my name out across the country, and I was able, and to, well, they did that, and then also I was on Austin City Limits.
Right.
In 2000. So... that got me some national exposure, but I didn't really get any radio, didn't get any print or anything. So it was super under the radar. But I did get a national following where I could go play clubs and do 200 people right. in San Francisco or 150 people in Portland or 300 people in Minneapolis or whatever, which allowed me to tour. And I've been doing it ever since. So
yeah.
12 years of touring, and now it's gone from 200 people in San Francisco to 650 people in San Francisco over the course of 12 years.
Right.
So it's been, it really, it feels like I'm filling up a bathtub on a day where it's slightly overcast and occasionally it'll sprinkle.
Right.
And then it'll evaporate and then maybe it'll rain and then sprinkle.
Right.
And then evaporate. But it really feels like filling up a tub very, very slowly. The good thing is the people that are fans of mine across the country are such loyal, diehard fans.
Yeah, very.
That, like, I feel like they'll come for the rest of my career because they've, it's so under the radar. They feel like I'm their property.
Yeah, they're God.
They discovered me. They own me.
Yeah.
And they're like, look at this. They well, show it to all their friends.
Right. Well, even people, and I'm, there's one lady who, a friend of mine that's a prosecutor, his wife is obsessed with one of your songs, and I can't remember which one it is right now. But your music also really connects. Like one of my very best friends, a guy I started my first band with in junior high, when I told him I was going to interview you just this last weekend, he told me that... shit, I can't remember what song it is. Maybe it's Round and Round. Maybe it's not. Maybe it's something else off of Lonely Land. But there was some song where his life had changed completely and he had split with his wife and he was on his way to his new place, like from Houston to Dallas. And the whole way, he just listened to one song, crying, of yours.
Might have been 2002.
Really, it might have been 2002.
Yeah.
But anyway, I was really moved by it. I thought it was amazing and what a great... I feel like that your fans have that with you. Even some people that aren't necessarily like Bob Schneider fans that see you every time you go to Dallas or whatever, there's still a connection that you've made with people through your pain.
Well, it's such a weird thing when you create any kind of art and then put it out there and then let people interact with that art.
Yeah.
Because it's such a... Like for me, it's like I enjoy creating it, but then I'm done with it.
Yeah,
like I don't ever listen to any of my studio records. The idea of listening to Lonely Land, it sounds horrible to me.
Yeah,
I listen to myself all the time, but it's just whatever I wrote working that day on, that past week.
What about the live albums? The constant
Never listen to any of them.
Oh, okay. I wondered if that started as a thing, like you, like a coach almost, like
what's that?
You go back and listen to the show and you come out like,
well, I used to do that. When I first started playing, like, and we could record our shows. Yeah, we'd play the show, then we'd go home, get drunk, get stoned, and listen to the show that we did that night.
Right.
Oh, look at this part. We really rocked it there.
Right, right.
But I mean, after doing that for
I can't listen
6 months
shows.
Or whatever,
yeah.
You're like, I don't want to listen to this goddamn show anymore.
Yeah.
So you just kind of, that kind of drops off, and the novelty of it wears off.
How did you, I mean, because that was a fairly unique, I mean, you started doing it like almost 10 years ago. Did you start doing that? Like burning the shows and selling them at the end of the show?
I know.
It's a long time ago.
I know I was doing a South by Southwest showcase with Mark Broussard, and he was the one that told me about it. Because he was recording his shows live and putting them on CDs and selling them. And what he had been doing was like opening up for another band where you get paid $250
right.
a show,
right?
Which you can't afford anything.
Right.
But he was selling like 100 of these CDs every show. So he was making like $2,000 by selling these CDs, and it allowed him to be on this tour without tour support. And I was like, oh, I got to try this out.
Yeah.
So, but I don't know.
Well, I remember doing
exactly
that tour
how long ago it was.
When I was with Endosheen. And
yeah.
I want to say it was the first time you did it, but I just remember the line at the end of every show and just going like, fuck yeah, this guy.
Yeah. People love.
Yeah.
People love it. And the good thing about it is the shows are pretty unique. You know, it's not like I have some sort of set show with 12 songs.
Do you run a set list or anything like that? Or do you?
No, I never. The only time I do set lists is on Monday nights. And I only do it on Monday nights because we're doing a lot of material that we're not familiar with on Monday.
Right.
But the shows, like when we toured with you guys,
right?
You know, we have like 50 or 60 songs, and then we'll play 24 of them in a show.
Right.
And then we'll make up shit.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and even I remember one time the show was slow and you performed like Hamlet or something, but not even like the original Hamlet with the characters' names. You used the actors from the movie that had just come out.
Yeah.
Like Meryl Streep.
Right.
Right.
Well, I mean, ultimately what you want to do is you want to entertain people.
Yeah.
Like whatever.
Yeah, that's what I like. That's the thing.
Whatever it takes to entertain people,
right.
That's your job when you're on stage.
Yeah.
So I will say
anything.
Anything that comes into my head that I think is entertaining, I will say, and I don't even think twice about it. And then afterwards, I'm like, I cannot believe I just talked about fucking my grandmother in heaven.
Yeah. Yeah. And my aunt was sitting in the front row. That happened to me a couple months ago. Not my grandmother, but I was talking about fucking animals and stuff.
Right.
But it's like,
but it makes it interesting.
Yeah.
Like, it's not going to be boring.
Yeah.
That's the worst thing you can possibly be is boring.
Same fear I have.
Horrible.
It's worth it, though. It's fun to say crazy things. You're a comedy fan, aren't you?
I love
follow
comedy.
Comedians. Go see comedy.
I love it.
Yeah.
And the one thing about being a musician is that I'm allowed to be funny.
Yeah.
Like, I can be funny.
There's some levity because some of your songs are pretty heavy. Not all of them. I mean, but you have some funny songs. But
I do have some funny songs, but in between the songs, I can occasionally be funny. But I don't have to be funny.
Right.
Because my job is to play these songs.
Right.
So it allows me to get away with being funny in between the songs. Whereas comedians
have to be.
There's
funny.
A mandate.
Right.
You have to be funny.
Yeah, that's.
And as soon as you're not funny,
it's over.
It's a real, real bad dark clouds.
Yeah.
It's not good.
Yeah.
But I can not be funny and it's fine.
Have you ever attempted stand-up? Ever?
No, I've never done it. But I have done that thing where I'll play in front of a crowd that doesn't know me, like that aren't fans.
Right.
That's a whole different ball game.
Yeah.
Like I'll say some weird crazy shit that normally my fans will be like, "Ah, that's funny, that's so silly,
scare people.
Insane." And people will be like, "What the fuck? You're talking about having sex with retarded girls.
Yeah.
That's not funny."
Yeah.
I'm like, I know, but the
if you knew me.
Only if you think that I'm being serious.
Right.
Is that not funny? But if you understand that I'm how ridiculous that is that it's funny.
Yeah. So you're working on an album now? Are you have an album? Are you kind of like, when was your last album? Came out like a year ago? Perfect Day?
I've recorded a record. It's done. It's in the can. It should come out in February.
Anything special about it?
No. Not at all.
I noticed you sell your stuff on vinyl.
My last record was the first record I've ever put out on vinyl. I was super excited about it.
Yeah.
But
was it worth it?
What's that?
Was it worth it?
I don't know.
Okay.
This is the way I feel about every record that I put out. I hate it. And then as the years go by, I start liking it. And then eventually I really like it. So this last record, I like about half of it. And maybe 2 years, I might like all of it.
There you go.
The record that I just finished recording, I'm pretty sure is the worst record I've ever made.
Okay. How'd you do it? What'd you do it
here? I feel that way about every record.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
You do. Sorry.
So it could be good, or it could be the worst record I've ever made. I have no idea.
You record it with your band and in a place?
I hardly ever use my band. I use whoever I think is going to
fit the
work best in the studio for whatever the project is that I'm working on.
That's a realistic way to do it. So who did you produce it? Someone else produce it? Who did this record?
Dwight Baker produced it. He produced A Perfect Day and Lovely Creatures and Christmas Time.
I listened to some of that Christmas Time. That's really good.
Thanks. Yeah. I love that record. It's Kevin Lovejoy and Chris Maresch. Is it Chris Maresch or Marsh?
I've always called him Marsh.
I think it's Marsh. It's spelled Maresch.
Maresch.
That's Marsh. And J.J. Johnson. Yeah, it was great working with those guys.
Good. And so we're at the Moody Theater. You're here tonight playing a private event.
Thanks
for letting me crash your backstage green room. I'll let you get to work. You got a sound check?
Got a sound check.
Is there anything I'm missing? You want to say hi to anyone?
Not really. I want some alone time with this mic.
I know. I'm going to leave it with you. Or just leave the cover. I'm going to leave the cover.
I'm going to put this cover on my cock. And it'll look very similar. My cock is about that color. And it'll just make me look like I got a bigger head than I do.
I've heard you talk about having a small wiener.
It's not super small, but it's similar to this mic. So if I were to put this on, look, that just makes, how much cooler is my cock with that on it?
I don't know how it looks without it.
It looks very
just like that. So. Then it looks super cooler. You're going to have the coolest looking cock in town. Bob Schneider, thanks for taking the time to do this.
Thanks, Johnny.
All right, man.
He said, son, you've done a fine job. I said, I know. I'm Batman. But you can call me Bob. Yeah!
Yeah. All right, man. So that one was a very requested interview from you guys. And so there it is, Bob Schneider. I'm glad he took the time. I'm glad I got to go down to the Moody Theater and hang out with him for a little while. It was nice talking to him. It was wild. I hope you enjoyed it. Thank you so much for listening to episode 101. That's right, bitches. Line up. I don't know what that means. Hey, people. Thanks a lot for listening. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter, like us on Facebook, and subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. And you'll be you'll find out what's going on out there. Music. I promise I'll keep you up to date. Whatever that means, either. Hey. I'm Johnny. Here's a little bit more Bob Schneider. Thanks to Bob. Thank you for listening. Bye-bye.
Of the Wizard of Oz movie. We're like, whoa.